Welcome to Facilitating the Mission, the podcast of Shepherd Staff Mission Facilitators. My name is Brian Mondock.
And my name is Jeff Jackson.
Happy day after 4th of July, even though this will go out just a few days after the 4th of July, yeah. But it's being recorded on July 5th, so.
Yeah. Yeah, well, same to you. It's, it's always good to celebrate the 4th of July here. We have, it's cool, this place that we moved into here in our hometown. We actually can see fireworks from four different cities at the same time.
Oh, that is cool. Are you guys up on a hill?
Yeah, we're up on a hill. So at 9 p.m., we can see the fireworks in Escondido, Rancho Bernardo, Poway, and Ramona for anybody that's listening that's familiar with that part of Southern California.
Well, yeah. Cool. Where I am, it stays light till after 9, so fireworks don't even start till 10.
Oh, wow.
And man, we had them going off here last night here in New England.
Yeah.
But
it's good, man.
You know what I saw? I saw you were at the ball game on your social media.
I was. Yeah. Actually, with Carlos. Carlos came, he's now San Diegan. So we took him to his first ever Padre game.
So did he have any comments about this? Is almost like a sidebar, but
yeah,
I just wondered, does he have any comments about how San Diegans do baseball and how they do baseball in Philly?
Oh, yeah. We talked about that a lot, actually, during the game. Because there's so many distractions and stuff here. And, it's a beautiful stadium. It's outdoor. It's right by the bay.
Right.
And, if you're a Padre fan, it's like the definition of misery. being a San Diego NFL fan, the Chargers or the Padres, it's like get used to disappointment kind of stuff. But but he was talking about how serious the Philly fans are, and how they'll turn on the players on a dime, and start booing them and everything. And the atmosphere is so laid back. He's like, this stadium is like so laid back and all the stuff going on, around the game itself.
That's hilarious.
Like, yeah, it's totally Southern California, San Diego,
Awesome.
Yeah, but hey, that wasn't all that happened this week. I know, I'm sort of going to commandeer the podcast today and say, hey, I saw that you put out your documentary about your daughter, your granddaughter.
Yes.
So tell us about that, how that came about real quick. And then I want to kind of use that as a springboard to talk about how that sort of connects with a call to being a missionary in a foreign country and God's sovereignty and all that.
Well, Jeff, you've known me for going on 20 years now.
Right.
And so you've walked through a lot of cycles with us, and you and you remember the incident that happened to my granddaughter, that she's a victim of shaken baby syndrome.
Right.
And my daughter had her when she was 19, and the biological father shook Allie and squeezed her till she wasn't breathing. Mm-hmm. And she ended up in a coma on life support for 10 days and in a coma for 10 days. And, and she came out of that coma severely brain damaged and handicapped, born 100% healthy. But after that horrible event, she's a quadriplegic. She has cerebral palsy. And my daughter, as a single mother, could not raise her. In fact, the state of California, she was living in San Francisco at the time, state of California took Allie away from her and put her into the foster care system. And then my wife and I left where we were in South Florida and moved to California to do everything that we could to adopt her.
Mm-hmm.
And so Shepherd Staff walked through that season with us.
Well, we did, and I want to, Cora, let's sort of put that on hold, and it just kind of let's kind of frame that event, that life trajectory changing event because within the realm of this podcast, Facilitating the Mission, you and I met because God's given both of us a heart for the nations, and so
absolutely.
So let's give the whoever's listening a little bit of our backstory together. So
okay,
So tell me when. Remind me, as a matter of fact, when did we meet, what were the circumstances of that?
One of the responsibilities at the church that I was a part of at the time, the Calvary Chapel Church that I was a part of in Northern Palm Beach County, was I wore the hat of missions pastor, and I think I think the first place we met was I sat in one of your breakouts at a missions conference that was being held at Calvary Chapel, Fort Lauderdale. And you were doing your missionary God talk.
Okay.
And then, at the time, our church was very much a partner with a ministry that was doing a lot of work and still is doing a lot of work in South Sudan. And so I traveled often to South Sudan to work with this ministry to train chaplains and pastors in South Sudan during the Sudan Civil War. And then
when you were doing that, was there an inkling that God could call you into full-time, you know, missionary service, or was it just, say, these were short-term trips? And
yeah, it started out as short-term trips, but there was some chemistry. So there was some strong chemistry and a skill set that I didn't realize I had, you know, for being able to live in under, you know, pretty serious hardship in pretty serious circumstances. It was something that I thrived in. I don't know how to say, I'm not trying to sound arrogant or anything, but it just really, it's just like, this is great. This is like camping where everybody else is depressed. And when do we go home? And this is scary. And I'm like, this is, you know, and connecting with the people there. And and as we did that for about 3 years, it became evident that, you know, there was a real place for me with that ministry. And so we when a position was offered, my family moved over there.
Okay.
And in that season, I went through missions training that Shepherd Staff offered.
Right.
And that's when you and I were kind of reintroduced to each other. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you're the guy that taught that mission. Because you taught missionary God.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, I've heard this before. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, Ed Compion, you know, Pastor Ed Compion was running the, you know, running the day-to-day operation there. And so that's when we kind of got reintroduced. Okay. And then we went to, and then, you know, while we were in Sudan, my wife had some pretty serious health problems, and we ended up having to come back.
Now, remind me, did you take your two kids to Sudan with you, right? They were both with you.
Yep.
Right. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Charity and Aaron, my son, he was middle school aged, and Charity was high school aged. Mm-hmm. And so they were there with us.
Okay.
And then, and you recall, Aaron and I were full-time at the school. Charity and my wife came. They couldn't be there full-time because just the way our schedules were set up at this
time. Right. And what year was that?
That was 2002/3.
Okay. All right.
And all the experience of all the travel back and forth started back in 99.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's going back some time, you know.
Yeah. So when you guys went over there, when you made the move as a family, and just sort of, again, trying to stay within the boundaries of the podcast, you know, and facilitating the mission, do you feel like you were sent well? I mean, did your home church, you know, send you well, for lack of
a better word? My home church did send us well.
Okay.
I was on staff.
Okay.
And, you know, I had a lot of benefits that a lot of people going from churches don't have. I mean, I was part of this church plant and was in leadership, and people loved our family. And I was also wore the hat of youth pastor, men's pastor. I mean, I had a lot of different roles at the church where, you know, I was very, very involved with the people that came to our church. Mm-hmm. And when we went, people were like, yeah, the Mondocs, they're built for this. Mm-hmm. And they really, really supported us.
Okay.
And my pastor supported us. My pastor was like, you know, here's, you know, he talked to the missions agency that we were going with.
Right.
We didn't know about, you know, the setup that Shepherd Staff had at the time. And so we were, my senior pastor really negotiated with, well, here's how it needs to work for the Mondocs. They're cared for here. We need to make sure that they're cared for by your organization.
Right.
And our church was pretty significant contributors to this organization.
Okay.
And so we felt like my pastor used that leverage to make sure that we were cared for. And so I feel like we were sent well.
And then you come back I'm assuming you came back because of, you know, the health issues that Susan was having. You came back earlier than you expected to.
Yes.
So you had to deal with that sort of disappointment, right?
Yeah, okay. It was incredibly traumatic.
Okay.
And I don't know if you know, it was the same time you started having some serious health issues. It was the same year.
Right.
And so we had had, I mean, it was a real, and what that did for our relationship, that's when our relationship grew, because, you know, I became your East Coast representative at the time.
That's right. Yeah.
And then also, the classes that you trained me in, I stepped into that role for a season,
right,
and trained missionaries while the school was receiving students at the time. In fact, we talked about Calvary Chapel San Diego. The pastor that was the pastor at that time, you know, he had missionaries going through that.
Right.
It's such a small world, you know.
It is.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's where, you know, we really saw that there's this sort of a gift, or what, you know, there's that there was this stateside administrative support sending role that was a fit for me.
Mm-hmm.
Even because when I came back from Africa, I went back on staff at my church, and my pastor released me to really, you know, invest time into shepherd staff. And,
right,
you know, we worked, you know, I interviewed, you know, every missionary, you know, in the Southeast United States that was being onboarded into shepherd staff at the time,
mm-hmm,
you know, to serve. And then we, you know, as my wife started to get a handle on her health issues,
mm-hmm,
and my kids were graduating high school. My daughter had already graduated high school. My son was getting ready to graduate, and we started preparing to go to the Middle East.
Right.
And that's when we were started having that conversation with you,
right,
and the folks at Calvary Chapel Fort Lauderdale, whose project it was, you know, that they were kind of overseeing the work that was being done in the Middle East at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to mention the country.
Sure.
Because,
right,
you know, for security reasons, and there's serious security reasons there right now.
Right.
But we were going to go there as undercover missionaries as part of a language school.
Right.
And that was something that I was also doing, you know, once we came back from Sudan, because I had that experience in pretty serious parts of the world. I started going to other serious places, like in the Middle East.
Right. Right.
Cuba.
Right.
Cambodia. You know, any place that was, you know, where our military had conflict in the last decade or so, it seemed like, yeah, that's where I want to go. Okay. Being the ex-Marine that I am.
Right. Yeah. 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 Huh.
And so we were getting ready to go to the Middle East, my wife and I, and we had been invited by an organization that was kind of a branch of Operation Mobilization.
Okay.
And the way that it worked was they had an in-country undercover believer that was a 51% owner in this language school that taught English and English students Arabic and Arabic students English from all over the place. And people used to come from all over the Middle East from several countries to go to these schools. And so I was going to work there and pilot was going to be a language cafe, kind of wouldn't be a school, but it would be like seminars, like language seminars, ESL seminars and stuff, but it would be like in a cafe setting. And
okay.
And it was actually a really cool offer that we were working through. And then as we were, you know, I had just gotten back from another mission trip, doing a field visit with missionaries that we had in Costa Rica. And that night I got a call from my daughter, who had already had Allie, had moved out to San Francisco.
Okay.
And said, "Dad, you have to pray. Allie's in an ambulance on her way to the hospital."
Wow. And that's that is a life-changing moment right there, right? You didn't know the gravity of it at the time, but would you say that you were in the chute and you would have been on the field in that Middle Eastern country within a few months, right? Wasn't that the plan?
Oh yeah.
Was that far along?
probably less than 90 days.
Right. Right.
Where we were in the conversation, less than 90 days.
Okay.
And I had already, because I was a missions pastor working with everybody's missionaries.
Right.
I was fortunate enough to have some real good conversations with lead pastors about what our support would look like.
Right.
And I mean, we were that far along. We had our house listed.
Right. Okay. All right.
Yeah. I had totally forgotten about that, but yeah, we had our house listed. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the one thing that was, you know, that's always a factor. So
sure is. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny because you know, and just on a side note, for those of you that are thinking as you're listening to this, maybe God's calling us to be missionaries. That idea of if you own a home or you're, you know, you have a house that you're paying a mortgage on, that big decision of whether you sell it or whether you sort of rent it out. And I think this is similar to your case where you were in Florida as it is out here. You know, the advice is, listen, if you're in a place like Florida, California, and you sell it, you pretty much ought to give up the idea that you're ever going to be able to resettle here. Because the ever-increasing cost of home ownership is not going to change while you're gone. So if you sell it, the possibility of you coming back is slim and none. If you live in a place where it doesn't appreciate at that rate, it's a different story. But I mean, you wrestled through all that too, right?
Yeah, we wrestled through that, but we also budgeted.
Yeah.
We had put into our budget, you know, to start saving for coming back.
Okay.
With some of those things in mind, because it was in the season that we were in Sudan that real estate went insane.
Right.
And we sold a house then that we had gotten some pretty quick equity in it. Mm-hmm. But then while we were gone, man, it like the house doubled.
Mm, yeah.
And our real estate agent said, nah, you don't want to rent it. You know, renters, they'll trash your house, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then we came back after a much shorter season than we planned on.
Right.
And everything, rent was going crazy. Everything was going nuts.
Right.
You know, that was before the market imploded, but
right.
That was the time. That was the heat up to the market imploding.
Right. So when you're on the flight out here and you just, you know, you get the news from your daughter that Allie's in the hospital, she's not breathing, you know, whatever. I mean, you're thinking in the moment, you know, what's going on with her, whatever. And you have no idea, you know, what this is all going to mean for, you know, for your plan, right?
Yeah. What I did is I brought her car. We still had one of Allie's car seats because she lived at home with us for 6 months,
right,
before they moved out to the Bay Area. And I did not know the gravity of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, you know, my daughter was traumatized. She was not relaying news to us very well.
Right.
And so I had in my car at the Fort Lauderdale airport, I had her car seat.
Okay.
Cause I figured she was going to come. And we said, okay, when she gets out of the hospital, she's just going to come live with us.
Right.
She's like, Dad, we just can't do it. Blah, blah, blah. The dad just was, you know, he was going to go to jail for whatever happened. He was arrested and everything.
Right.
But we were just like, okay, well, we'll bring her home. Mom and I will take care and we'll figure things out after that. But when we got there, I was not prepared for what I was going to see. I mean, Allie was surrounded by apparatus and beeping machines and lights and wires.
Yeah.
And her head was completely bandaged with all these electronic nodes coming out of it for the EKG or EEG. I forget which one it is. And so that they can monitor brain activity. And they had a heating lamp on her because due to the brain damage, she wasn't able to maintain her own body temperature. So they had to put her under a lamp and she had she was on a breathing machine. She had tubes going into her, down her throat and then food tubes going through her nose. I mean, I, as a grandfather, and I was a young grandfather, I think I was 41 at the time, I was devastated, man. I had no idea how bad it was. And the thing is nurses were whispering and nobody thought she was going to live.
Right.
And I had my friend who was a nurse back home get on the phone with one of the nurses and, you know, to really have, cause I didn't know what all the stuff meant, you know, all the numbers and all the everything. And a doctor hadn't really talked to us yet. And she got on the phone with the nurse and they had like a girl to girl conversation. Yeah. And my friend Kathy, who actually lives in San Diego now, she told me that, she was very honest with me and said that they don't think she's going to live.
Man. Okay. And then,
my daughter just, she was in shock, Jeff. I mean, she just denial shock. Right. I mean, it's, you got adult daughters. Yeah. You can't, you know, just what she was going through is no dad wants to see his kids go through, man.
Yeah. And then the corner turned, right? So she hung in there and then there was a turning point.
No.
Okay. All right.
Allie. Daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. What happened was she was in an ICU and after 2 or 3 days, she started to maintain her body temperature.
Okay.
So she was in a coma. She's on breathing apparatus and she started to maintain her body temperature. So that was the first little thing, but she wasn't breathing on her own. And then after she was in a coma for a week, they said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to take her off the breathing machine. We don't know what's going to do. They had run some kind of tests and there was positive. Yes, we're ready to try. It's not, yes, we're ready. Yes, she'll be okay. It's like, yes, we're ready to try taking her off the breathing apparatus. Mm-hmm. And so they took her off. But before they did, you know, we're having this conversation, like we're going to have another conversation if she can't breathe on her own. And so they took her off and she started to breathe on her own, which was huge, but she's still in a coma. Right.
Okay.
And I mean, brain activity is improving, but you know, we see all these movies about people in a coma or whatever. And it's like, they wake up and like, where am I? You know, and they're right back where they were. And that's wasn't what was happening with her. And so the next little event happened was Susan flew out to San Francisco. I've been in San Francisco for 10 days, living in the hospital, living partly in a hotel, but then they had a wing. They had a wing at the hospital that they weren't using, but had a lot of hospital rooms and beds and stuff. And so they let me stay there, in this wing that was like a storage, had all the storage, plus it had rooms and beds and showers and stuff. Nobody else was living there. So I was like living, it was weird. It was just the most surreal thing. Yeah. But I lived in the hospital, ate there, you know, and then would just stay with Allie in ICU.
Right.
And then Susan came and then we both stayed there at the hospital. And man, they were so good to us, Jeff. They were so good to us at the hospital, that staff. Right. And they had a chaplain there that was amazing. Yeah. And the doctors were all very much so supportive of us. And so the day that Susan got there, one of Allie's eyes started to open as if responding to Susan's presence.
So this was like 10 to 12 days after the event?
Yeah.
Wow.
And meanwhile, you know, the dad's parents are also there.
Right.
And it was tense, you know. The mom is, his mom is just the neatest lady. In fact, she just was visiting us here. Allie had her 13th birthday and we're like, the parents didn't do it.
Right.
And so we're going to do everything we can to keep them involved.
Yeah.
But that was at that time, we one of the things is like, we're like, this is our life now. We're doing this. I mean, sorry, everybody that we talked to about this, but this is our life now. We have to do this.
So it's kind of just a decisive mindset that God, this is what you have in front of us. This is clearly what you want us to do and everything else is put to the sideline. Yeah.
Yeah, this right. is it. I mean, everything was put to the sideline, Jeff. I mean, everything, the job, the house, where we lived. We had no idea where our future was going, but we knew that we had to be a part of, you know, whatever it was that was going to bring this girl back, if she was going to come back. We didn't know, but this was it. This was it. Everything else. And we had just, and we had the full support of the church I was working for. I mean, I am just overwhelmed with, you know, there was like, it was, you know, people say, you know, we're a family, you know, as a staff or whatever, but we were a family. I mean, we just, they just loved us unconditionally, made sure that we made sure that we went without any, you know, there was, we didn't go without anything. Right. If there were any shortfalls, we'll handle it and figure it out later. And so that was how it was handled. So we, I mean, this church really, really cared for us.
That's beautiful.
And it was, and we didn't know what was, where we were going to go. But what ended up happening was we got into kind of a, you know, with the courts and everything, we got kind of into a little, we got into a spot with the city of San Francisco because now the dad has a lawyer. My daughter has a public, like a lawyer assigned to her. And then Allie has a lawyer because all of these different people have to be represented in court now as they decide what's going to be the
best plan of action.
It's not just the plan of, the plan of action, but there's a legal, there's a legal track and then there's a medical track.
Okay. All right.
And so Allie had a lawyer that they felt like the best thing for her was to go into, because of her disabilities and potential, the care that she was going to need was to go into this system in San Francisco to be cared for by the city. And one of the things to San Francisco's credit was because they were the epicenter of the U.S. AIDS epidemic in the late 80s, early 90s, there were a lot of kids that were orphaned.
Right.
And so there was this infrastructure, there became this infrastructure for caring for, you know, disabled kids. Right. And nobody was doing it better in the country. Yes. And so they were building the case that Allie needed to go into this. Mm-hmm. And Charity had a lawyer, but Charity's lawyer was for Charity, you know, to keep her out of trouble because they were like looking at, you know, was she neglectful or, you know, how could this happen? I mean, she was under investigation by the Child Protective Services. And of course the dad, you know, he was in the city jail but we don't have representation.
Yeah.
and the state and the city, the Child Protective Services is like, we don't know you.
Right.
This child could be going from the frying pan into the fire.
Right. Which makes sense.
We're not your friend. That's right. I mean, it makes sense if it's not you they're talking to.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But it was us that they were talking to, and we're like, nobody loves this kid like us. Thanks for listening to part one of our interview with Brian Mondock, our co-host on the show. We'll wrap up this interview next time on Facilitating the Mission.